2023-1605, McCormick versus the United States Department of Treasury. Cagney?
Yes, sir.
You can begin whenever you're ready, and you've reserved 5 minutes of your rebuttal, is that correct?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you very much. May it please the Court. I'm Bill Cagney. I am proud to represent the treasurers of the states of New Jersey and North Carolina.
Can I ask just a point of information before I get started, sir? With these custodial escheat statutes provide that the state shall have beneficial use of the REIS, if you will, of the bonds, right? Well, what are some examples of beneficial use?
In the case of North Carolina, one of the examples of beneficial use is that in addition to a full-scale effort to find the owners of the bonds, the state has statutory authority to use some portion of the bond proceeds to fund higher education scholarships and other aspects of education.
So if they use those funds, some portion of it, for that purpose, and the actual owner shows up, does the owner get 100% of the face value of the bond, or do they get only the amount that hasn't been spent?
The owner always gets 100% of the bond plus whatever interest has accrued on those bonds. That's simply the beneficial use of money pending.
I had trouble with the concept of beneficial use. What happens if the state uses the money and then the state goes bankrupt? I mean, the state's actually going to take the money. I mean, they're going to get the bonds registered in their name as custodian, right? That's what you want.
That's one way.
It's the same way you get for minors. You have something registered in the name of the parent as a custodian under the Uniform Gifts to Minor Act. You're a registered custodian, so you have title to do something with it.
Well, technically not title.
Who's going to give you the proceeds?
The Department of the Treasury.
They'll actually pay you the proceeds.
That's part of the escheat claim under the unclaimed property statutes, mm-hmm. and as is done in other examples by the federal government in every other institution in the United States. When there are unclaimed funds, the funds are provided to the state to hold in custody while they look for the rightful title owner. And in the meantime, some portion of that money by statute is enabled to be utilized.
Now when you say, Mr. Kenny, when you say the proceeds, you're talking about the face amount of the bond at maturity, correct? It's a $10,000 bond, and the maturity date is, say, June 1st, 2006, and all the interest has been paid, the coupons, the face amount of the bond is what are the proceeds, right?
Well, Your Honor, in the case of savings bonds, I don't believe there are coupons or interest, so the interest would accrue.
It just matures.
So it would be the face amount of the bond and whether or not there is any additional interest that's accrued, because there are differences from one type of savings bond to another type of savings bond.
So that I'm clear on this, and I have the same questions, Judge Clevenger, but just to make sure we understand what the basic ground rules here are. The difference between the new type of statutory escheat and the old type of statutory escheat, I take it, is that the state of North Carolina can use that money to fund education or whatever other statutory authorization it has. But if I, the face bondholder who has been missing for 20 years, should show up in 2020 and say, where's my money? The state of North Carolina has imposed upon itself the obligation to pay me. Whereas under the old system, the state of North Carolina could say, sorry, Charlie, this is cheated as of the following date, and you're out of luck. Is that what it comes down to, essentially?
That's correct.
All right. So you're putting yourself in a position that you're keeping the door open to this missing person, however unlikely it may be in a particular case, that that person will show up. That's what the new statutory structure provides for, correct?
Yes, Your
Honor.
Okay. Mr. Canyon, where physically is the bond?
The
piece of paper.
The savings bond would be somewhere in the possession of either the title holder, that is the person who purchased the savings bond, such as yourself or myself, or it may be lost. It may be
destroyed.
It could
be at Merrill Lynch.
It could be sitting in a vault
someplace. A lot of places, if it's physical. I mean, some of these things probably today are not don't have physical embodiments. They'd live in a computer, I would assume. Maybe you're real.
I think in the case
bonds,
of savings bonds, they're all physical. Right. I believe that's true.
I think today you buy a treasury bill, you don't get a piece of paper. You get a representation from your broker that you have rights and you hope the computer doesn't lose it.
That's correct. We're talking about savings bonds, which are...
So at this stage in the game, with this case, the government has conceded error. The government has said that it should not have asked to have the case transferred to the Court of Federal Claims.
Yes, they have, Your Honor.
And there seems to be no contest at all about the propriety of the transfer order. The answer is it was wrong. So the case is going back to New Jersey. The government doesn't want the case to go back to New Jersey nudum pactum, so to speak. The government wants the case to go back to New Jersey with the instruction to dismiss the case. Right?
Yes, sir.
And so the question is, do we have authority to tell? Is that right? Are we authorized to tell the district court to dismiss the case?
That is the question.
Or are we not authorized?
The question is whether or not you are, and with all due respect, your jurisdiction is limited so that you are not authorized to instruct the district court. May I?
Why is that so?
We're here pursuant to a specific limited grant of jurisdiction, which is Title 28, Section 1292D4A. I better check my notes to make sure it's
close enough.
B.
Close enough.
We know what you're talking
about. What happens if we knew? Let's assume for purposes of argument that you stood in front of me and you said, it's sort of an interesting point, Judge Clevenger, but the short of the matter is, our side has carefully thought about this case, and we have decided there is no final agency action. And you just want me to know that although it's probably a jurisdictional fact, you're prepared to concede no final agency action. Am I still without power?
I'm sorry, Judge. I'm prepared to concede.
Yeah, assume for purposes of argument that on the way into the court, your client instructed you to say that your client had read all these briefs and had decided that there is no final agency action here with regard to your claim against the government. That is to say, there is no factual predicate for an APA cause of action, unripe.
It's a great question, Judge. I would think you always have jurisdiction to accept a voluntary withdrawal or a voluntary dismissal of an appellant's appeal. But I think to...
Why? If all that came up here was the transfer order, your theory is that the transfer order sends us only one issue and one issue only, which is whether the transfer order was correct, yes or no.
I think the analysis would be because all you would be doing at our request would be to dismiss an appeal. The government's not asking you to dismiss an appeal.
Well, we're going to dismiss this appeal anyhow. This appeal is getting dismissed in a way because you've all conceded that the case doesn't belong here. If the case doesn't belong here, I've got to get it out of here somehow.
Well,
remanded?
It's his appeal, so I guess we don't dismiss the appeal. We send it back to...
We send it back.
Relief. Right.
It's getting remanded.
Right, right.
But my problem was I didn't understand why it is that... that we are completely without authority. The Supreme Court tells us that we should always address not only our jurisdiction, but the jurisdiction of the lower court.
With all due respect, that's not quite what the Supreme Court tells you. I would submit that what the Supreme Court tells you is something like what Justice Scalia or Justice Ginsburg would say, and that is that the government here is trying a drive-by jurisdictional ruling. The Supreme Court would say...
Bender said every federal appellate court has a special obligation to satisfy itself not only of its own jurisdiction, but also that of the lower courts in a cause of action under review.
If you read about an inch or an inch and a half above that quote, Judge, you'll see what is fundamental since Marbury versus Madison and before, and that is that your power comes from two sources. It comes from the Constitution, and it comes from statute. Your statutory power as you sit here today is limited to 1292, the statute I cited. Your power is limited to looking at the transfer order that's before you. Once you determine that the transfer order is wrong, your obligation is to come to a full stop because
right,
your
if there
power
were
of
no, if there were no cause of action, if the lower court had no jurisdiction, there would be no Article III case or controversy.
I'm not sure I follow your question because I don't agree with that, Judge. If you look at some of the court's own rulings, such as Texas Health, such as the Navy case, such as
Texas Health didn't concern itself with whether or not there was jurisdiction in the Court of Federal Claims to which we were transferring that case. The precise issue here, I don't think, was really framed in Texas Health Choice. I realize the language, what the language in Texas Health Choice says.
I'm not sure how you're articulating the precise issue here as compared to some of the cases that
this
court
has addressed.
Well, if you
take our Awad case, A-W-A-D,
yes.
Which wasn't, do you know the case?
Well, I know of it.
It wasn't cited in the briefs. In
yes,
Awad, we had a transfer order. The case was transferred to us.
Yes.
Right? Or the case was transferred to the Court of Federal Claims. And there was a challenge to the transfer order. And we said, no, the transfer order is fine. That's where the case should go. And the other side said, well, you can't send it to them because they have no jurisdiction. Now, what did we do? We said, we'll address that question. And we'll decide that in this instance, the smart thing to do is to send the case down to the Court of Federal Claims and let it inspect the jurisdictional facts to decide whether or not the case fell within its jurisdiction. On remand, the Court of Federal Claims looked at it and said, nope, we don't have jurisdiction, and dismissed the case.
I think the difference there, Judge, is that you were sending back a cause of action that you found properly belonged within the jurisdiction of the Court of Claims. Your jurisdiction under 1292 is limited to a yay or a nay, essentially, was the transfer order proper. If you look at some of the other cases that the Supreme Court has written on this question, and that is, how far does your jurisdiction...
Right, but you told me earlier that my duty to satisfy myself that the lower court has jurisdiction is a constitutional duty. Marbury against Madison. I think that's what you told me.
I did not, Your Honor. What I did was respectfully to refer you to a couple of lines above that quote, because your job... ends in this case, it ends before you determine whether or not the district court has jurisdiction of a separate cause of action that's not before you.
Congress can tell me that I don't have the authority to decide if a lower federal tribunal has jurisdiction.
Yes, in a manner of speaking, it certainly can, Judge. Congress
why should Congress be able? Statute may be unconstitutional. Why can Congress tell me that I can't decide. Go back to my hypothetical. In this case, you all have conceded that their transfer was incorrect. Let's assume that both sides agree that there is no final agency action.
Because there is, I think the answer to your question, Judge, is because there is no general federal appellate jurisdiction. And so Congress determines when and under what circumstances by statute jurisdiction can be exercised by a court. And that's why I referred you to the quote just above Marbury versus Madison, where they say the court has always said you have to look for your source of power in two places. In the second place, the statute that we have before us, it's very, very narrow. It might be good to think of it this way. If this case had somehow been appealed to the Seventh Circuit, or if any other case had somehow been appealed to the Seventh Circuit, would the Seventh Circuit have any power to say would the Seventh Circuit have any power to say anything other than this doesn't belong here, full stop, send it back? Could they look at something coming from, say, another district court not in the Seventh Circuit and say, oh, this is interesting. How come we found this case up here? Let's take a look at it. And in fact, that's what happened to this court.
Let me ask you, because I'm jumping in on you because the time is driven. You said we have to come to a full stop and just reverse the transfer order, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Does that mean we could not say the order of the district court transferring the case to the Court of Federal Claims is reversed, the case is remanded to the district court, which must determine its own jurisdiction?
That you could not say that, Judge?
Are you saying we could not say that?
You could certainly say that. I wouldn't interpret that as a ruling. Obviously, the district court has to interpret its own jurisdiction.
Okay. So but you Judge, say we could say that?
Yes, you could.
Yeah.
I think that's stating self-evident. Let me put that question in perspective that may help clarify where we are with this.
Now, you're into your, you've used up all of your rebuttal time. Do you want to?
Yeah, can I just ask one question? In connection with your rebuttal argument to Mr. Chadwick on whether or not there is final agency action here, I think you pointed to a press release, I believe, or something on the internet, right? The Treasury saying they wouldn't respect
the Treasury policy set forth on the internet.
Is there any reason why your side didn't refer to the letter from Mr. Van Zeck, to the Honorable Richard H. Moore, Treasurer of North Carolina? It's attached to the plaintiff's sir reply brief.
It wasn't part of the record before this court,
record.
Judge, and ripeness was not raised per se until the second
if it wasn't
brief
part of the record, that's
of the defendants.
Okay.
It's part of the record below in the sense that it's appended to the brief. The example I was going to use, Your Honors, is it reflects back to the Christensen case, which this court encountered some time ago, where the court, in an exercise of truly good faith, Judge Markey wrote an opinion after having transferred the case to the Seventh Circuit. The Seventh Circuit transferred it back, and Judge Markey said, you know, we don't have jurisdiction, but the Seventh Circuit seems to think we do. We'll write the opinion as a matter of manifest justice. The Supreme Court said, with all due respect, the court was acting with some good faith and good intentions, but it had no jurisdiction, and it should have retransferred the matter right back to the Seventh Circuit
rather than write
the ruling.
We'll give you your full 5 minutes of rebuttal. We'll hear from the government. Mr. Chadwick?
May it please the court, good afternoon. It is regrettably true that we wouldn't be here on this issue if the government hadn't mistakenly argued.
Was this handled by the U.S. Attorney's Office before, or by federal programs, or who handled it?
It was the United States Attorney's Office.
Okay.
And, that has happened. But now that we're here, the case is no different from any other appeal in which this court can determine that the court below lacks subject matter jurisdiction.
Let me test that proposition, because I really wonder. Suppose that, just to make this preposterous, this were a case which originated in the Justice of the Peace for Pecos, Texas, Judge Roy Bean. And an appeal was taken, and Judge Roy Bean transfers the case to the Federal Circuit. Now, do we really have both the right and the obligation to decide whether Judge Bean had jurisdiction in the first instance before we send it back to him?
You'd have to answer that question by looking at 28 U.S.C. 1292. And in that case, Judge Bean would not be among the enumerated courts in Section 1292 D4A. But a district court is. And in 1292, what you have jurisdiction of is not the issue. You have jurisdiction of the interlocutory order, Section 1292 uses that term in every subsection, the interlocutory order. It's not the issue. It's the order before you.
With the transfer order.
Correct.
Right.
And the entire order, and the issue has been clearly decided under the with respect to orders granting interlocutory or injunctive relief. You have jurisdiction to review the entire order when an order comes before you because it involves a grant or denial of injunctive relief. The same is true of certified questions, which come up under Section 1292. You don't have to decide the certified question itself. You have jurisdiction over the entire order in which the certified question.
Well, what's the order in our case? The order was to transfer the case to the Court of Federal Claims.
But the order is on page 27, and that order denies the motion to dismiss and grants the motion to transfer, but there's nothing special about your review of that order, which is limited to any.
What's the order? What did the order say in Texas Health Choice?
I believe it said much the same.
Same thing.
And I'm not going to try to really
attempt
to
distinguish.
I won't ask you why you hadn't addressed Texas Health Choice in your brief, right?
It's just a timing question. I think it just wasn't brought to our attention as we were drafting this. But
timing question. Okay.
It's just not a case that
March 05 was Texas Health Choice. March 06 was your brief.
Yeah, arguably, it just didn't turn up.
Okay.
In the
so what's the answer now?
The answer now is Texas Health Choice framed the issue in a mistaken way based on prior precedent. Texas Health Choice.
Oh, wait. Say that a little more slowly. And
Texas Health Choice states that. We do not. This is on page 898.
I'm reading it. We do not
have jurisdiction to address the district court's denial of OPM's motion to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction because
it's not an appealable.
Is not an appealable interlocutory order. That respectfully is not the issue. It's not whether that order standing alone would be an appealable interlocutory order. It's whether that is contained within an appealable interlocutory.
Well, you're telling me that the order in Texas Health Choice was the same as this one. It was an order
yes.
that granted the motion to transfer and denied the motion to dismiss for want of jurisdiction.
That's right. And if this panel follows Texas Health Choice, you will reject our argument. I'm not trying to get around that.
Walk me through slowly why it is we should not follow a binding precedent.
Because, as I was saying, under 1292, the question is not whether any individual issue would be an appealable order. The question under 1292 is whether this court has jurisdiction of an appealable order. And that in Texas Health Choice it did.
Okay, well do you have a case that precedes Texas Health Choice that holds that we do have jurisdiction
under different sections
over something other than the transfer?
Under different sections of 1292, but interpreting the identical language, the interlocutory order words of 1292. The Supreme Court held in Yamaha Motor versus Calhoun, 516 U.S. 199. The Supreme Court held that with respect to the certified question jurisdiction under 1292B. The appellate jurisdiction applies to that.
What did it hold?
It held, in short, that the appellate jurisdiction of the Court of Appeals applies to the order certified to the Court of Appeals. It's not tied to the specific question formulated by the court. This court has since said that also.
Was this in the context of a transfer?
No. That was, as I'm saying, these are different sections of 1292, but the operative language is just the same. It's the Court of Appeals has jurisdiction over an interlocutory order under different sections of 1292. When that occurs, the court has jurisdiction over the entire interlocutory order.
So you're telling us Texas Health Choice was incorrectly decided, although it was a transfer order case, it should have recognized these other related sections?
Yes. Yes. And this court held in King Instrument versus Otari Corporation.
You don't draw any comfort at all from Awad?
Comfort? Well, certainly.
What's different? Why isn't Awad a previous precedent?
Awad, to be honest, Your Honor, I didn't review it this morning, but Awad reflects the fact that the jurisdiction of each court, the transferor and the transferee court, will always be at stake in a transfer case. This court always addresses the jurisdiction of the transferee or transferor court in these cases. And this case is no different from that.
How could a WAD have made it under Texas Health Choice?
I didn't formulate the issue that way. I think you're right, Your Honor, that it's inconsistent with Texas Health Choice.
That's right. Yes.
Wasn't a WAD a case in which this court said that the case did belong in the Court of Federal Claims?
Yes.
Right, as opposed to one in which we said it doesn't belong in the Court of Federal Claims and therefore isn't a case within our appellate jurisdiction, ultimately, except for the transfer. It seems to me that's a fundamental difference, isn't it? Because once we have a case where we say this case is a case before the Court of Federal Claims, there's a lot we can say about what ought to happen in the Court of Federal Claims. We're going to see it later. We can tell the Court of Federal Claims what it ought to do. It seems to me a rather different proposition from telling a district court over whom we have no reviewing authority except with respect to the issue of transfer, what it ought to do, thereby potentially putting ourselves into conflict with, let's say, in this case, the Third Circuit. I mean, what, for example, if we have a different set of law as to ripeness from the Third Circuit? What happens? We issue an order directing the district court to do something with respect to the order. Let's say, declare it to be unripe. It goes to the district court, and a new appeal goes to the Third Circuit, in which case they come out the other way? That seems like, to say the least, it's a bit inefficient and a bit presumptuous of us, isn't it?
I understand the question. One could certainly think of policy reasons along those lines, reasons of comity, but as I suggested, first of all, that's not what Section 1292 says. 1292D says, just like all the other sections, that this court has jurisdiction over an interlocutory order. It doesn't say, for the purpose of deciding whether the transfer should or should not have been granted, it says you have jurisdiction over the order. So that's the scheme that the statute creates, is the fact that you are reviewing something that comes from a district court. Secondly, that's fundamentally what you just described is fundamentally, I understand there's a difference, but fundamentally what this court did in Texas Health Choice, because you told a district court in the Fifth Circuit that had concluded that it had jurisdiction, that it did not, and that it had to send the case to the Court of Federal Claims. That's the nature of review of these kinds of cases. You will be opining on the district court's determining. Right.
But that's the transfer issue.
But yes.
That isn't the question of subject matter jurisdiction in the underlying case in either the district court or the Justice of the Peace Court of Pecos.
Well, I mean, in the district court, I mean, I understand that the issues were divided in the court's opinion between the motion to dismiss and the motion to transfer. But in effect, once this court determines that there is Tucker Act jurisdiction, you have, in fact, in a case like that, determined for all intents and purposes that there was no APA jurisdiction in the district court and the case should be transferred. That's the reality of a decision like that. It's not always the case in everyone, but that's what happened in Texas.
But that's just a necessary component of the transfer decision, which we are required to make. I don't see how that requires us to go farther and decide, for example, that there wasn't in personam jurisdiction over the defendant.
Well, because you have jurisdiction of the appeal, then there is no reason that the other precedent to which the court has directed our attention that we cited in our brief, the Supreme Court's cases on the obligation of the court to determine its the tribunal below, whether that tribunal has subject matter jurisdiction. There's no reason why that would not apply in an appeal like this.
Mr. Chadwick, let me ask you, though, why is it wrong for us in this circumstance to say, and I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Mr. Cagney, I asked of him, the decision to transfer the case is reversed, the case is remanded to the district court in New Jersey to determine its jurisdiction. And isn't that most appropriate where the question of jurisdiction turns on how one finds certain jurisdictional facts? We shouldn't be in the business of doing that. What's wrong with that? I mean, that seems like the sensible thing to do here.
I understand, and it's an outcome.
I mean, if there were no fact issues, but the question of whether the district court had jurisdiction turns on certain facts, right?
But not disputes of fact. This is not a case in which we are saying something that the states have said in their complaint is not true, and therefore there's no jurisdiction.
Well, but there's a question as to whether there's been final agency action.
But that needs to be alleged in the complaint in an APA case. And what is alleged in the complaint at page 21 of the joint appendix, and 22 of the joint appendix, paragraph 34 of the complaint, is simply referring to the internet website statement by Treasury, and that is not final agency action. This complaint is not alleged final agency action.
Well, but on a jurisdictional issue, you really have to make sure you know what the facts are. I mean, this whether there's jurisdiction here turns on facts. And we're not in the, I don't think we could determine these facts. Isn't it just best to send it back to the district court to decide these jurisdictional facts?
If you would conclude that the issue turns on facts, then the answer is yes.
To be pristine, you certainly agree that the court has the authority to issue an order saying the order transferring the case to the Court of Federal Claims was in error, was wrong. The case is, that order is reversed and the case is remanded, period.
Yes.
We certainly can say that, right?
Yes.
Now, can we add a sentence to say, upon remand, the district court shall satisfy itself that it has jurisdiction?
Certainly within this court's authority to say, and as I was going to say...
And Mr. Cagney agrees with that.
Right, and that, too, is not a result with which we'd be greatly unhappy, I mean, to be candid. That's the issue we're raising, though, is, in fact, that there is no jurisdictional basis, in our view, for this court not to reach the jurisdictional issue that arises from the complaint in this case now, in this appeal.
Other than Texas Health Choice, which you concede is binding on us unless we are willing to write an opinion saying it isn't worth the paper it was written on. Correct?
I wouldn't go that far.
You might not choose to use those words. But you know, we get charged with writing the little opinions that circulate to all of our colleagues before they issue to the public. And we don't lightly write opinions saying that an opinion written only a year or so ago was a waste of paper and ink.
Well, it certainly wasn't, because that was a sort of a fulcrum of that decision where the court went on to address the transfer issue in great detail and just didn't address the motion to dismiss. That I'm not quibbling with the fact that it is a holding of that case. But I've cited you also two cases that define interlocutory order in Section 1292 in a way that is inconsistent with Texas Health Choice. So our position is that under prior precedent, just the error that in that case is that the court framed the issue in a mistaken way with respect to whether a motion to dismiss is an appealable order. That's not the issue. It's whether that ruling is in an appealable interlocutory order, which it was in that case and is in this case. So our point, as it gets down to it, is that there's nothing special about a Section 1292 appeal that should stop.
Well, let me
court.
Ask you this question. If this particular cause of action if we remanded with the order to dismiss the case for failure to state an APA claim, and then let's assume that the states of New Jersey and North Carolina go to the government and ask to have their custodial escheat statutes enforced, and they get something that everybody would agree is final agency action. Are they going to be barred from filing a new lawsuit?
No, absolutely not. I mean, that's not this wouldn't be the death knell of their claim. It's just simply be a dismissal for lack of jurisdiction without prejudice. And that's what an APA claimant should do, is essentially go and get final agency action if you haven't got it. And that's, there's nothing.
Well, if this case goes back on the order that Judge Shaw suggested someone might write, then presumably the government is going to stand up in the U.S. District Court in New Jersey and say you don't have jurisdiction because there's no final agency action, right?
I believe so.
And then that question is going to be ventilated in front of somebody who ventilates those questions all the time, unlike us. And it's going to be ventilated by a fact finder who will put folks under oath and who will, right, take testimony on the jurisdictional facts. Correct?
I think one of our arguments would be that
what I'm getting at is, why does the government think it's a good idea for an appellate court to roll up its sleeves and convert itself to fact finders, especially in an instance in which you're dealing with a motion to dismiss on the pleadings, which has to take everything that's fairly alleged in the pleadings as true?
Well, we don't argue that. And as I said to Judge Shaw, if you were to conclude that there are disputes of fact that the court would have to resolve in order to determine whether it's final agency action, we suggest you should not tell the district court what to do. Our point in this case is that final agency action must be alleged in an APA complaint, and what is alleged here and is asserted to be it says in the complaint that this herein fulfills any requirement that may exist for final agency action, that's what the states were attempting to do, is not final agency action and does not satisfy the one of the basic conditions for APA jurisdiction. You can see that from the complaint. That's our position.
Thank you, Mr. Chadwick. Mr. Caney, as I said, you have your full 5 minutes of rebuttal if you need it.
Yes, if I may, Your Honor, first with respect to the last stated item, in paragraph 34 of our amended complaint, we certainly do allege final agency action. If counsel is saying that there's a fact issue, then obviously that's something that that this court can't.
No, I think he's saying just the opposite. I think he's saying you said so, but you didn't have sufficient satisfactory showing in your complaint that would establish as a matter of law final agency action.
And I think the law is that on the pleadings, which is where we are in this case, there's been nothing filed in the way of pleadings besides the complaint and amended complaint. This court's job is to look and accept the allegations as stated. If I may return back to Judge Clevenger's questions about 1292 and what Marbury versus Madison talk about. And if I may cite you to two additional cases that are not in our briefs, but do get to this issue precisely, I think, and that is the issue of how far the court can go once it makes a determination that its job is done, which is where we submit you are today. One is Steel Company versus Citizens. Actually, Judge, that is cited in our brief, but it's not discussed. It's just cited. It's at 523 U.S. 83. And that's where the Justice Scalia talks about subject matter jurisdiction being both comprised of constitutional power and statutory power. He also quotes from a case that predates our parents' days, and that's Ex Parte McCardle, M-C-C-A-R-D-L-E. It's at
Common Law Courts, yeah.
It's at 7 Wallace 506, and at page 514, the Supreme Court back in 1869 said, we cannot doubt as to this. Without jurisdiction, the court cannot proceed at all in any cause. Jurisdiction is power to declare the law, and when it ceases to exist.
Right, but Mr. Chadwick says under settled law in the interlocutory order field, we have jurisdiction over the order. You don't quibble with those cases, do you?
Well, Judge, I don't quibble. Yes, I do, Judge. I do quibble with that because the order that is under review is the transfer order. Now, what the judge in the district court did was enter an order that did two things. It denied a motion to dismiss, and it ordered the transfer. Technically, if you read the statute, 1292, your jurisdiction is to look at the transfer order. He's calling the order a piece of paper.
He leads me to believe, I find out when I read his cases, he leads me to believe that this issue has arisen in other aspects of interlocutory appellate review, where someone said, oh, well, there are two aspects of the order, right? And both aspects of the order are in front of the appellate court.
Well, I would look at the statute, Judge. I would look at 1292, and I'd look at the order. 1292 says only one kind type piece of an interlocutory order is under your power, and that's the transfer order. The other part of the paper order he's talking about technically is the order of the judge denying his motion to dismiss. Now, if you want to talk procedure, then under Rule 28 of the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure, your practice rules, or your rules of appellate procedure, Rule 28, and under the, I think it's the Bailey-Dart case, if he wanted to make that argument, he should have filed a cross appeal. But, Judge, that, with all due respect, I think that's a...
Well, you're saying a situation would be different, for example, if you had a denial of a J-Mall and a denial of a motion for a new trial in a case on one issue, there's some other issue in the case, and somebody yet tries to bring an interlocutory order up.
It certainly would,
say,
Judge.
Well, maybe the appeals court can look at both the J-Mall and the new trial issue if they take interlocutory jurisdiction.
It certainly would, and if I may, there, another example is the review of a temporary restraining order or an injunction. There's a specific statutory provision on that, and there's a case that's cited on the fact that ripeness in that context should be evaluated because it's an element of what the court must consider in whether or not to grant injunctive relief. But that statute which was 1292, I think, A or
B.
C1, B, gave the court different power than the court has today as we bring the transfer order before you. I think that's the United States Association case that was cited in the government's brief. And that's at the United States Association case at page 1348, and it's cited in the government's brief at 8, 11, and 12. I think Judge Bryson and Judge Clevenger, if I'm pronouncing your name correctly, forgive me if I'm not, Judge, I think you both raised the question that I didn't get out of my mouth the first time around, and that is, well, let's look at what would happen here if you accepted the government's position and you did what the government wants you to do, which is not what the statute authorizes you to do. You would be sending an order back to a district court that says to the district court, make a constitutional and jurisdictional ruling, obviously without a record. At that point, assuming the district court honored your ruling, which I'm sure it would, then we would be forced to go to another circuit court on appeal. We would be filing an appeal with the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, contesting that ruling. And we would have the situation of essentially or potentially dueling circuit reviews or dueling circuit decisions or at least dueling circuit reviews of the same issue.
It'd be the ultimate split in the circuits, wouldn't it be?
I guess it would, Judge.
Different decisions in the exact same case.
I think it would. And I think the Supreme Court in Christensen, that's one of the things they said, that we have to avoid that. There is something called the law of the case doctrine, but sometimes it has to come to an end. And that's when the Supreme Court said to this court, you really do need to stop when you finish your jurisdiction and let the case move on and follow its course.
Thank you, Mr. Cagney.
Thank you very much.
The case is submitted.